The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 17th of September, 2020. On the podcast today, Neil Clark, CEO of Destiny Pharma. DEST is ticker there. And Neil provides updates on the phase two clinical study of their lead asset and other parts of the business. Also on the podcast, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's Bitcoin, blockchain, cryptocurrency news and talks about some stocks as well that he's been dabbling in. And Alan Green, CEO of Brandon Communications, talks about Travis Perkins, Itaconics and Power Metals. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see top 10 visions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, and you see a lot of content there. Check it out. There's articles, there's blogs, there's videos, there's podcasts, and our COVID-19 index. Biggest riser there on the index today is Tiziana Life Sciences, up 7.14% to 157.5. Biggest faller, Open Orphan, down 4% to 14.25. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Clark, CEO of Destiny Pharma, that's DEST ticker. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. Good to meet.
Yeah. Well, virtually, as most people are these days, of course. And of course, you're very active in that sort of area, and we'll find out that in a bit. But you've released two bits of news today, talking about your clinical trial update, phase 2B, and obviously interim results, so lots to talk about. Before we do get into that, Neil, for people not familiar with Destiny Pharma, just give us a summary as to what you're all about, please.
We're a UK biotechnology company which is developing our own intellectual property. So this is our invention. Our founder, Bill Love, and who discovered the XF platform, and we're developing new anti-infectives. So our core portfolio, the XF platform, is looking for preventative treatments against bacterial infections. And then we also recently announced that we have a COVID-19 research project, which is grant funded. And so across the board, we're really interested in bringing new products which provide better treatments to battle infections.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, let's go into, first of all, your lead product. You've had an update on the phase 2B clinical study of your lead asset, XF73. First of all, explain what it's about and explain where you are with this, if you could.
Yes, so XF73 is our lead program. So it's in the middle, or almost completing, hopefully later this year, phase 2B studies. And it is for the prevention of post-surgical infections such as MRSA, which is methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. So Staphylococcal aureus is a bacteria that sits on us, in us. Specifically, a third of the world has a higher concentration or higher numbers of this bacteria in their nose. And if you are a carrier of Staph aureus in the nose, so a third of the world is a carrier, when you go in to a hospital for a serious operation, so orthopedic surgery, hips, knees, heart surgery, spinal surgery, you have a 10 times greater risk of a post-surgical infection, which means that the Staph aureus that is in your nose gets into the wound and can lead, of course, to some very serious infections. So this is a well-established problem across the world, and our drug XS73 is targeted at the nose to kill the bacteria in the nose for the period of risk, which is really the day before surgery, the day off surgery, so that there's less chance of picking up one of these serious hospital infections. Because, of course, if you do pick up a serious hospital infection, not only is your recovery slower and you have to take more drugs to treat the infection, that it obviously could be more dangerous, it also costs a lot more because time in hospitals and time to recovery costs thousands of pounds a day. So a very, very clear clinical need and a very clear pharma economic argument for bringing this new drug through. And there is currently not really a great drug out there on the market. In fact, in America, which is our main market, there is nothing approved. So XF73 nasal gel is our lead program. It's in phase 2B clinical studies. And we announced today that we're, after a delay due to COVID, We're now at 88 patients out of a target of 125. So we're looking to complete that study. Recruitment at the end of the year, we're saying announced data Q1 2021, and that's a really important valuation inflection point for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And and as far as, you know, money's concerned, you're funded for that?
Yes, so that was the other message today from our CFO, Sean Clayton, that we actually IPO'd 3 years ago, and we've managed that money well. I'm an accountant, Sean's an accountant, our chairman's an accountant. We also have some scientists and medics as well, don't worry. But we have been managing the money well, and we have money until Q4 or to the end of 2021. So we're looking to deliver that key data in the next few months, and then we have a good runway to manage our options thereafter. And one of the reasons that we're able to stretch the money and have made it work very hard is that we've also attracted since our IPO, or since 2018, over £2.5 million worth of grant funding, whereby we're working with collaborators, universities, and indeed companies, and attracting grant funding from largely from UK authorities. But that's been great, because of course that goes to work on those earlier programs, and we can focus most of our resource and cash on the lead asset, which is the key value driver.
Yeah, absolutely. And moving along, you've just announced a sort of collaboration with a company called SporeGen for COVID-19. Can you explain this, Neil?
Yeah, so as I said at the start, you know, Destiny has its own XF platform, its own discovery platform, which we're developing into the clinic. And we've always been open to bring in new technologies. And SporeGen is a company we know. In fact, the chief executive of SporeGen, Professor Simon Cutting, I was actually at school with in Windsor many years ago, and I met him at a conference in 2019, having not seen him for 30 years, but he's a world-leading expert in bacillus and also in vaccines. And he's had several projects he's worked on, but one of which is a potential prophylactic, a preventative treatment for COVID-19, and he's got data where he has shown that his formulation of bacillus prevents influenza infection, and we're looking to extend that work now and show hopefully that it can also work against COVID-19, the virus infection. So it will be delivered against the nose, so it fits very nicely with our lead program, which is also a nasal gel. This would be a nasal spray. We would take it. I would take it perhaps if there was a local outbreak of COVID-19, or indeed I was an at-risk subject. You would take this nasal spray over 2 or 3 days to stimulate your innate immune system to give you sort of protection, specific protection against COVID-19 outbreak, or potentially actually influenza or similar viruses, say COVID-20 if there is one. So it could sit alongside vaccines, or it could be potentially a replacement for vaccines. So we're very pleased, as well as the scientific credibility of the project through Professor Cutting's work, but also the validation we won with SporeGen. We won an £800,000 Innovate UK grant. Again, this was announced a couple of weeks ago, but it's very interesting for us. It brings in a new program, different technology into the company, which obviously we share with SporeGen. It's their invention, their discovery. It also moves us into sort of the biologicals microbiome space. So we're excited with that. It's early stage, but obviously COVID-19 is obviously a very serious and hot topic, and we're pleased to expand our pipeline and very excited to get that grant support.
Yeah. And if someone's, you know, listening to that and thinking, okay, there's a huge race to get the vaccine. You know, I think at the moment there's been 9 big companies, really big companies, in phase 3. Where do you sit with those companies? I mean, what's the chance of you succeeding where they maybe, or well, they maybe succeed as well, but some may fail? How do you fit in with that?
No, you're right. I mean, and I think, you know, stand back, there's a global need for new treatments, preventative and indeed managing when people do pick up these viral infections. So that's the starting point for this mad rush and effort to deliver treatments. And obviously vaccines have very high profile approaches. They won't all work, of course. I think there's over 150 approaches. Vaccines, if you look at sort of things like the annual sort of flu vaccine jabs, it's known that they have to be have to be different variants, maybe on an annual basis, because of course the viruses change. So vaccines will have to continue to be developed. Vaccines aren't always 100% effective. Mm-hmm. They can maybe be a partial solution. So our treatment, our potential treatment, which will be a nasal spray, could sit alongside vaccine programs, or indeed if vaccine programs don't prove to be, you know, sort of the golden arrow with a 100% solution, you know, they could be in combination. We, of course, wish everybody well with all of their work, but ours is quite a different approach in terms of stimulating the innate, which is our sort of natural immune system, whereas a vaccine, of course, is looking to make your immune system adapt by effectively giving you a small dose of the infection and stimulating sort of the immune response, which then prepares you for when you come across the actual infection itself. So there's an elements of competition, but I'd say there's more elements of 1 + 1 = 3. So we're happy with the novelty of our approach, and we believe that's actually why we managed to attract the grant support, the Innovate UK and their scientific review. You know, they've also heard our rationale and bought into that as well. So you know, obviously it's early stage, and we need to deliver data, but definitely we feel we can. You know, we're not threatened at all by the big guys in that space. Happy to work with them. We think there's more than enough room for our approach, even if there's a couple of vaccines are successful as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so looking forward, so the next big milestone is the readout, is it, on your phase two?
Yes, completing recruitment, we're saying, by the end of the year. And yeah, then obviously you complete recruitment and then all the data is going into a black box. And then effectively you clean up the data a little bit and then you press the button and the statisticians look at the actual data and you get statistics on the data. Is it great data? Is it good data or indifferent? So we're obviously confident we're expecting to deliver good clinical data, but that is the key value driver, and really excited about finishing recruitment and getting to that data.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Neil, every day on the podcast I highlight the top 5 most followed companies, and of course to get in that list, people have to hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets. So right now, if you could give us 3 quick reasons why someone should hit that button on Destiny Pharma's page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I think we're in control with our cash to deliver a key inflection point in the next few months, which is that phase 2B data. We also have an earlier pipeline, as we've shown with the SporeGen project, we can expand that. And I think coming back again to the fact that cash, we are in a decent position with our cash runway. So great data coming, and we've got the cash and the capability to deliver that. So watch out for that news.
Excellent stuff, Neil. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman. He's an author. He's a trader. He's a full-time trader, and he's a part-time author, I suppose. What are you writing another book, Glenn, or not?
Not at the moment, so I can't really call myself a full-time author, no.
Yeah.
I wrote that book out of love, Justin. You know, you can't summon love from nowhere.
Well, there's not a lot of love scenes in it, is there? I've scanned through it and stuff. I didn't see any of the hot, you know, sort of Milton Boone type scenes or Jilly Cooper type scenes.
There was a lot of love for the crypto.
Oh, okay, I see.
It's hard to kind of have physical relations with a cryptocurrency. So,
some of those Bitcoin maniacs, on social media, it seems that they are in a massive deep romance with Bitcoin, aren't they?
It does seem that way.
In fact, they're not doing a romance with it. They are one of those. They are a partner you wouldn't want. They're like the fatal attraction kind of partner. Those people, you know,
yeah,
literally bunny bollies.
I just find it weird when their actual Twitter profile is like a shrine to Bitcoin. You know, like their bio is all about Bitcoin. Their picture is of a Bitcoin. It's just like, is that your entire life? Is that what you are?
The mistake we make, I think, is that we believe those people are normal, or we assume they're human, you know, when in actual fact they probably can't strike up a conversation with another human, and the nearest they get to a relationship is with either a computer or, you know, a cryptocurrency. And that's so, you know, if you probably talked to them, they wouldn't understand how to respond in a way that we would.
Well, there are two different types. There's those who you're talking, those definitely exist. They're also the ones who are just obsessed with it for financial reasons, because they've put so much of their life, or in some cases, all of their life savings into Bitcoin. So that's why they set up the online shrine, because basically their entire future rests on the success of Bitcoin. It has to succeed or they're screwed.
No, but I think there's a lap and overlap. You know, if you did a Venn diagram. And in fact, this is quite relevant. I was going to say, sci-fi came first, then Wi-Fi, now it's DeFi. But sci-fi,
yeah.
I believe, a lot of people who are, you know, these obsessed cryptomaniac, obsessed Bitcoin sort of, you know, champions, I assume they're into sci-fi as well.
You're making a lot of assumptions there. But I guess it's fair to say that a lot of the people who got into crypto early, because they were generally IT people, who they were the ones who discovered it first and made the first early fortunes, just like, you know, a lot of the time they were just kids in their houses and stuff. I spoke to one person, for example, who got in really early, and I know several people in this situation who got in really early, mined a ton of Bitcoin, and then basically forgot about it and threw away the hard drive at some point. Yeah. And, you know, the most famous case I talk about in my book, because I interviewed him, the guy who has $100 million worth of Bitcoin, an IT worker from Wales who told the council, the local council, he'd give them 10 million quid if they would dig up the landfill where his hard drive is supposedly buried. So far they've refused, but he's still kind of holding out hope, because the Bitcoin that's buried there is worth potentially up to $100 million. What's that? About 80 million quid, 70 million quid, something like that. What's the dollars, the pound these days? I can't remember. But there are smaller cases of that as well. Just like, as I say, a guy just messaged me the other day telling me about his woes.
Where did they bury IT people. Where did they bury the... So he just chucked it out, did he? And they obviously went to landfill.
Yeah, often it's a case of, well, like the guy who contacted me the other day, who's lost millions, in his case, he was just a teenager. He was literally 12, well, he was preteen. He was 12 when he was mining the Bitcoin. And now that he's sort of 19 years old, during his teens, his dad just, you know, his parents have a clear out of your room or whatever. Dad chucked out the old computer that he wasn't using anymore. It's gone. All gone. In the bin.
Oh, there we are. There we are then. That's it. So anyway, DeFi, like sci-fi, Wi-Fi, DeFi. We've mentioned it before. I've had the guys on from KR1, which is, do you know what KR1 is?
KR1. Yeah. I know them personally.
The guys from there have been on the podcast sometimes, and they've talked about in investing sort of.
They used to be called Kryptonite.
Yeah, Kryptonite especially, but then they had sort of legal problems.
With Kryptonite. I know. Warner Brothers threatening to sue them.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? I know. But so they're into that, and they've mentioned that a lot, and they've invested in quite a few tokens, currencies in that space. Just explain what it's all about, Glenn, if you could.
Right, well, DeFi, which we've talked, I've referred to it vaguely on the podcast in the past, but it's really blowing up as sort of the most exciting area of cryptocurrency now. It just stands for decentralized finance. So I think I've talked before about how it's sort of similar in ways to a platform like Zopa, or the sort of funding circle type platforms, those kind of things. Basically, peer-to-peer finance, which was, we've had it in the UK for more than a decade in a non-cryptocurrency sense. What happened was platforms like Zopa, they have a centralized structure. You know, they're a proper company that manages everything, but they make it so that people can contact each other and decide how much money to lend to each other in a very structured way, though. It's not done in such a kind of ad hoc fashion. So that was the original structure that we had in this country. Excuse me, got a bit of a frog in my throat.
I wouldn't say it's an issue. That was a bit of cryptocurrency, I think, coming up there.
I think you could be right. It was DeFi, decentralized finance, takes it a step further by automating the entire thing, and it's completely decentralized. So, as with most cryptocurrencies, there's no kind of central authority deciding things. And the idea is that people can lend from one to the other, lend money. You've got money to lend, you lend it, somebody borrows it, and you get, in many cases, a pretty decent interest rate, which is why the sector is so popular at the moment, because in some cases you can get, for example, you know, 6% a year interest as opposed to the 0% or thereabouts that you'll get in your bank account.
That smacks of it. How do you get, I mean, I understand, you know, certain companies give dividends like that, but how did they get, are they earning 6%? Are they getting, you know, that's a good return, isn't it? Just seems to be
it is a good return, but, you know, well, because people want to borrow money and they're willing to give you 6% a year for the privilege of borrowing your money.
Yeah, but do you know what? You are giving, what, real money to people who will... Crypto, I understand. So it sounds to me that the real money will go and you'll probably not get back what you want. So
all right, well, look at this. I'm on Zopa at the moment, which is the proper regulated British platform, you know, the one I just described. Mm-hmm. And it says generate projected returns between 2.3 to 5.6%. So, you know, 6% odd for the decentralized finance thing is not out of the realms of possibility if even with Zopa you're getting sort of 2.3 to 5.6. But it has to be said, Zopa is, you know, a regulated platform. Yes, your money is, of course, at risk because you're lending to other human beings. Your capital is at risk and you've got fees. But with decentralized finance, it's even more scary. And I think that really needs to be hammered home to people because there's some of the structures that are being set up, and there are new ones every week. More and more new cryptocurrencies being invented with new lending, borrowing structures. And some of them resemble Ponzi schemes. You know, I ain't going to lie to you, Justin. Some of them are dodgy as hell. And it really worries me that, you know, all it takes is for the cryptocurrency market to crash, say, when the value of tokens falls, because people are getting paid not just in fiat currency. This is for the money that they lend. You know, you get your interest back. On some platforms, you get some of it in fiat currency, but some of it in tokens, right? And there are other platforms where you get only tokens as your interest. So if these tokens then fall massively in value, you could end up with the Ponzi collapsing. And in fact, Vitalik Buterin, the inventor of Ethereum, the boy genius who invented Ethereum, has been warning about the risks of decentralized finance just this week. He warned not just about the things that I've just pointed out, but also about smart contract risk. The fact that, because as I say, it's all programmed in. So the transfer of money and interest from one person to another is done using programming, using smart contracts, which was something that have been in all cryptocurrencies since Bitcoin, but Ethereum really makes great use of these smart contracts. Anyway, he's saying that some of these new cryptocurrencies are so badly designed, you know, there are basically bugs in the software. And so as a result, they could be hacked. So money's stolen that way, or they could just fail to pay out when they're supposed to. You have to be very careful about what you're dealing with. And at the moment, he's warning of it because thousands of people are pouring money into these new untried, untested protocols, these new cryptocurrencies, not even just the established DeFi. The more established ones are called things like Compound, which I've mentioned on the podcast before. But there are, as I say, lots of new ones. One called Sushi had a very dramatic scandal around it this week when the guy who'd set up Sushi took millions of dollars out of it and then had to apologize and put it back in. And I mean, like, it's as somebody described DeFi, it's the Wild West of the Wild West. The Wild West is the crypto space, and DeFi is the Wild West of the Wild West. So anyway, after all those warnings, I'm now going to tell you that I buy and sell these tokens because it's like, you know, as we've talked about before, it's a bit like the AIM market. You've got lots of small up and coming companies, or in this case, cryptocurrencies, some of which are growing enormously in value.
Listen, I know AIM, some AIM companies just promise and promise and promise and don't ever deliver, but it's regulated, isn't it? Is now,
yes, there is a difference. It is regulated.
The crypto markets, I mean, so you've got some redress, I suppose. Not a lot, really, to be honest.
Not much. You can still lose all your money on AIM.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest, if a CEO just lies and doesn't deliver, and the share price goes down, you know, there's not really a lot of comeback from the FCA. They won't even bother. The FCA will only get involved with stuff if it's, you know, involving hundreds of millions, really, and lots of people. So, so I suppose not a difference. But there's no regulation on crypto, is it, at the moment? It's just nuts, isn't it?
It varies from country to country. But when it comes to some of these new decentralized finance cryptocurrencies, they're set up by anonymous people sometimes, so you can't sue them because you don't know who they are, and yeah, as you say, there's absolutely no regulation in most countries governing these things. For the mainstream cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, there is more and more regulation coming in. We could talk about this at length another time if you like, but Europe, the UK and the US
are all in the process.
So yeah, it is quite boring, but they're bringing in lots more regulation at the moment in those territories, particularly in Europe and America. But anyway, as for the decentralized finance, yeah, as I say, I don't do any of this lending borrowing stuff because I find it too dodgy. You know, if I lend my money onto this platform in the hope of getting 6% back in a year's time, what if the cryptocurrency collapses in the meantime and I lose all of that money? I'm not interested in that side of things, but I am interested in buying and selling the tokens themselves because some of them have been in wonderful trends. And you know how I love a good trend. So, for example, Wi-Fi, spelled Y-F-I, is one that I've been buying and selling a little bit, and it's gone up in the past month from about $5,000 per coin to, and bear in mind you can buy fractions of a coin, you don't have to just buy an entire $5,000 coin.
Well, it's gone up. It's not even a real coin, is it, let's be honest?
No, it doesn't exist in physical form, but it's a decentralized protocol, finance protocol. It's gone up from about 5,000 to about 40,000 in 1 month. So, you know, you can't turn your nose up at potential gains like that. That's the thing. That's why I like trading.
You can, really.
Well, if you don't want to...
Eight
times your money.
Are these all on what platform are you on there? Is it IG? Is it?
This one is on Binance, which is the world's biggest cryptocurrency trading platform currently.
I set up one on Coinbase, and I don't know. I used it a little bit back a while back, and I haven't used it since. And I don't know.
Coinbase is that they're much more hesitant to introduce new tokens onto their platform, so it kind of takes them longer, and often by the time a token is listed on Coinbase, it's already kind of had big gains in the past, is already very established. So Binance, albeit far less regulated as a platform than Coinbase, as I say, it's the biggest one in the world, so I'm prepared to use it with at least a small portion of my money. I certainly wouldn't put my life savings on the Binance platform because it's set up in China. You know, if it goes bust, you're not going to get any redress, that's for sure. So I just have a small portion of my money on there. I trade using margin so that I only have to have a small amount of money on the platform. But then I'm able to trade these little tokens like Wi-Fi from almost the moment that they appear on the platform, because quite often they start rising in value quite soon after they list, probably because so many more people suddenly have access to buying and selling them. It just kind of sparks interest, obviously. Suddenly they're on Binance and everybody can trade them, whereas before they might have only been trading on tiny little obscure platforms that nobody was able to use. So there are opportunities out there for the brave. So, you know, one's for the brave is how I would class this.
Yeah. Okay. And what is the price of Bitcoin at the moment? Is it doing anything?
It's in a sort of trading range at the moment. It's at 10,674 as I speak. So it's still holding just about above its kind of main breakout point. It's still kind of... You know, it's in a trading range. What can I tell you? I'm not particularly excited about Bitcoin at the moment, and that's one of the reasons why I'm focusing more on some of the smaller cryptocurrencies, because there are huge gains going on, and it just seems ridiculous to be focusing on Bitcoin all the time and the little ups and downs, and oh, is it in an uptrend or isn't it in an uptrend? Meanwhile, under the surface, there are all these other cryptocurrencies bubbling away in fantastic upward trends, making lots of money for people. And I want to be one of those people, so I'm trading some of them.
So is it just a case of really, when a new token comes online, jump into it, get the gain, and then that's it, just jump out?
In some cases, that's what I have been doing. In others, I have been more optimistic and hoping that they will become a big deal. You know, because I look into the technology behind them, I don't just sort of buy them not knowing what they are. I look into the technology behind them, and some of them have got real prospects. they're still only kind of speculative prospects. Like, for example, Polkadot. Did we mention this on the podcast, Polkadot?
No, but KR1 hold a big chunk of Polkadot, I think, yeah.
Oh, really? Well, then they must be quite rich now, depending on when they bought it. But it's been rising in value.
They've had it for a while, yeah.
Right, well, they've probably done really well then, because it's been rising in value considerably. And Polkadot, the reason that they were clever to invest in it in the first place is because, well, first of all, they would have got it at a much cheaper price than me, I expect, if they bought it in some sort of early funding round rather than when it listed on Binance like I did. But Polkadot was set up by Ethereum's former chief technology officer, a very clever guy, a PhD from MIT and all the rest of it, you know, not some idiot. And he set it up to try and solve a lot of the problems that he thought that Ethereum hadn't solved in its structure. So the idea was to make a better version of Ethereum, the Ethereum killer, if you will. But it's still worth a lot less than Ethereum on the market, which is what makes some people think that it's got a lot further to go on the upside. But of course, all of this rests on the assumption that other projects are going to start using Polkadot as the basis for their own cryptocurrencies, as the basis for their own projects. At the moment, most projects use Ethereum as their basis, you see.
I see, yes.
So I'm getting a little bit technical, but it's...
This is the platform for others to launch their project. Okay, cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Marvellous. Yeah. Anything else, Glenn? You know, you got 8 minutes. And in fact, I think it was six minutes, actually, because you always overrun. If I give you eight, you just go up to 10. Anything else you want to chat about?
Well, should we talk about other markets? I'm happy to talk about those because you know I trade them. You know I trade them, Justin. The commodities markets,
stock markets. What have you been to? Come on.
The stock markets, all of the wealth. I actually got quite a few stocks at the moment, American ones. But, you know, I'm still much of the opinion I have been right since the beginning of coronavirus, which is that it's dodgy as hell. We all know that the stock market is based on a house of cards to some degree. At the moment, valuations in America in particular are very, very high historically. But, you know, if there's profit to be made, Justin, I've got to get that money. So I've got a number of stocks, but as I say, I'm prepared to kind of duck out of them at the first sign of danger is the way I'm looking at it. So, for example, I've bought Coca-Cola, which is going quite well at the moment, but, yeah.
Are these spread bets? You don't own the shares. You're just buying spread betting, are you?
I do both, actually, when it comes to shares.
But what about
Coca-Cola?
Sometimes
I buy them through a spread bet platform. Coca-Cola, I bought it through a spread bet platform, yes, because it's because it wasn't available through what the ISA provider that I've got a number of different ISA providers. I use a number of different ones to spread out my money between them, which is probably a little overcautious, but just in case, you know, Barclays goes bust or whatever, I like to not have too much of my savings in, you know, because there are the government limits, aren't there, for how much they'll recompense.
Let's get back on the stocks. Come on.
All right. Sorry. Back on the stock. Anyway, so, but Coca-Cola is an American, it was a stock that wasn't available through the ISA provider I checked. So I just thought, rather than checking my other ISAs, I'm just going to buy it on the spread bet platform instead. So I bought it on there. And
why did you buy Coke?
It's in a nice upward trend.
On the chart. Is it? Okay. All right.
What? Based on the chart?
Yeah, but why did you buy Coca-Cola? Because I think, isn't it one of those things now that's basically the trend is going to end on that soon? I mean, obviously they own lots of different brands, but Coke itself, you know?
What, you mean the actual drink is going to get less popular as time goes on?
Yeah. Aren't people just more aware of these, you know? I mean, they're probably diversifying, but they are at the moment, I suppose, with no sugar and all that stuff, but in the end...
Well, I mean, it's funny you say that because I drink a lot of Coke Zero, which has no sugar in it, but I like the taste of it because it tastes, unlike Diet Coke, which I never liked and always thought tasted artificial, Coke Zero, which is, I mean, it's weird that they brought it out. It's like, we've now got this new thing and it's also got no sugar in it, but it's not Diet Coke. It's called Coke Zero. And it actually does taste different from Diet Coke. I think it tastes more like the normal Coke. So I actually like to drink it. I don't drink
That's because it's got sugar in it. Just got sugar.
No, it hasn't. It's got no, that's why it's called zero.
No,
zero sugar.
You don't believe them, do you? Let's be honest. You're just saying that. Just saying, look, we got this thing. It's got no. It tastes exactly the same. Try it. It's exactly the same. Yeah, that's good.
So you think
it
if
is.
I did a science experiment and I tried to distill my Coke Zero, there'd just be a ton of sugar based at the bottom of my science beaker once I'd finished.
Yeah. Yes. It will be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Absolutely. They're just lying, aren't they? Let's be honest. For a long time, there's cocaine in it. They didn't tell anyone that.
Oh, that's true. I think they did tell people that. That's why it was called Coca-Cola, wasn't it? That was the origin of the name.
No, they've never actually revealed the ingredients, have they?
You're talking like 150 years ago, something like that.
There were suggestions, and then they tested it. They say, okay. People sort of. I just had an email from David Beck. he's missing ham. I mean, my email's got that all the time. David Beck. So, anyway, I just popped up there with David Beck. Oh, David Beck. There's something missing there, isn't there? Anyway, yeah, so Coke, anything else? We still haven't got past your first stock. Anything else?
Do you want to know about the ones I own currently or the ones I'm looking at?
What are you looking at? It could be thousands. The one you own.
I'm looking at this and this.
You said you got two recently
that I only talk about things I've already done.
Oh, you're 2 minutes.
So I thought, okay. All right. Well, I own I own BMW at the moment. I own Coca-Cola. I own JD Sports.
Yeah, I can see you dressed in a JD Sports tracksuit in a BM drinking a Coke.
Basically. I own Kingfisher, so I could drive down to... go to the... I'm getting distracted. Right, also Puma and Cellavision. And a bunch of American ones as well. Those were the European ones. In America,
why have you gone from nothing into about 10 stocks, whatever?
Because there was suddenly a bunch of breakouts, that's why, from long-standing patterns. Sort of ascending triangles that have been forming ever since pretty much sort of April or May in many cases. Well, basically what you had, I mean, you'll recognize it from just looking at charts yourself. So you had that massive decline in March, April, and then a lot of stocks recovered very quickly in a kind of V shape, but then they started going sideways, just kind of ranging sideways for months and months and months. So you ended up with a lot of these ascending triangle patterns forming where they were all bumping against a resistance point. And then a whole bunch of them broke
time
out
up.
Last week. All right, a whole bunch of them broke up last week, broke out last
no, time
week.
Up.
And so I bought a bunch of them at the same time because it was a signal that the market was feeling exceptionally bullish. It burst, a lot of them burst
time
through resistance.
Up.
All right, there you go. That's it. That's all I've got to say. That's why I bought so many all at once.
Thanks.
All right.
Yes, that's lovely.
All right, good.
Right. Speak next week. Thanks, Len.
Okay. Bye, then.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications. Sure, Al?
I'm fine, thanks, Justin.
Cool. What's happening stocks-wise, Al?
Okay, stocks wise, it's a pretty quiet time at the moment in the markets. I think the markets are just looking to see what the next moves are. Obviously, we've got we're back to six in a group today, aren't we? So that lockdown's there.
What a ridiculous policy that is, though. It's not like the thing is, I understood before the bubbles thing, where they try to confine you to your own family or your own bubble. But Now they don't say who that six people are. So literally, I can go and meet five people, five different people every hour, you know, every day. And if you're in a sort of, you know, some kind of a, if you're a single person in a swingers group, then you can get as close to possible as you want. So it just seems insane to me. I understand what they're trying to say, but I think they're just trying, rather than have, you know, introduce new rules that are a bit confusing. Just keep saying, you know, social distance, wash your hands, try not to spend time with other people. The less time you spend with other people, the better it is. But to give up these numbers and these groups, just confusing people. You know, just if you want to stop the spread, stay away from people, full stop. And that's it.
It's also yet more policy making on the hoof, isn't it? We've seen all the way through from this government that it's a reactive rather than the proactive policy reactive rather than proactive policy making, and all the way through, I think it's well proven by now that if you wear a face mask and you go into a public place, then you're by and large protected. You're not going to breathe in the droplets or whatever that carry the COVID virus. So at the end of it, I think the biggest problem, as far as I can see, is the fact that yes, we can move around, but if everyone wore a face mask, we wouldn't have the transmission rates that we currently have. But people are just blind ignoring it. I walk into the local Morrison supermarket here in Seaford. Half the people are wearing masks, half aren't. You know why? Mm. So why should that half walk in and get away with it? You know, they shouldn't be allowed in.
I think the trouble is now. I think what happened is this government made a massive mistake of not sacking Dominic Cummings, because that is, you know, people's just faith in the government, you know, so now just completely gone by the wayside, because, you know, he broke the rules. He knew he broke the rules. He was one of the guys in charge of setting up the rules. And so if he can get away with it, why can't anyone else? It's like one rule for them. And I think, you know, so people don't care. If he can do it, we can do it. It's simple like that. Yeah. They should have led by example there. And since then, now people are saying, I don't believe the government anyway. I don't believe it's that dangerous. But it's not. I mean, to average person who's healthy, this virus isn't dangerous. But there is a layer of society. It is dangerous too. And that's why we've got to still be, you know, until we get a vaccine, we've got to try not to spread it too much.
We've got to be vigilant. We've got to respect social distancing.
Not for everyone, just for those people who are... It doesn't affect me and you, pretty much, you know, or kids. It doesn't affect them. We know that now. But there are people out there who literally, if they catch it, they are going to be... It's going to be pretty much fatal for them. So until we get that vaccine, we've got to be a bit respectful. It's just people dissing it, saying, oh, I'm not going to wear a face mask. It's just against... That's almost a stand against the government rather than a stand against... rather than standing up for common sense, you know? It's been politicised a little bit, isn't it? And I think if you had someone in your family who had, you know, is very vulnerable in that category, you just basically take the measures to prevent it spreading. So... I think the government has messed up a little bit, because people are sort of really against the pandemic and trying to make a stand, when in actual fact it doesn't make any sense doing that, because it can harm society and they can lock us down again and harm the economy. So anyway, I don't know. I roll on a vaccine. It's going to happen sooner or later. We're going to get a vaccine for and it'll be given to the sort of most vulnerable layers first, the society. That'll help then, and we can go get back to normal quite quickly, I think, after that. So,
And all the time we have these other drugs, such as drugs for high blood pressure, and the other drug that was discovered a few months ago, dimoxazine, if I pronounce that correctly, that's used for Alzheimer's, I believe, or antidepressant, sorry, it's an antidepressant drug, that can also mitigate the worst symptoms for chronic patients. So all the time, the chances of you dying from COVID are reducing by the day. But in regard to controlling transmission, the single most effective thing is wearing a face mask. And so long as we're doing that, we're sanitizing and we're distancing. If everyone did that, we get on top of this thing. And that's the most frustrating thing. You know, people are just blind ignoring it. And you know, it's got to be enforced somehow. And it's the only way forward, as far as I can see. But I'm not advocating a police state. But, sometimes I think that might be the answer.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Stocks wise.
Stocks and shares. Okay. Right. So, the country is kind of bumping along the bottom at the moment, I think we're going to see some sort of recovery in construction and housing. The housing market has held up pretty well, but I think there's one of the companies that really is a great proxy for that is the builders merchant Travis Perkins, which of course owns the DIY chain Wix and several other well-known outlets. Now the company announced its half year revenues last week, which showed a fall of 19% and a loss per share versus 45 pence versus earnings per share of 4.2 pence the previous period in 2019. However, the company did make an adjusted operating profit of 42 million. And throughout the period, it's been working to reduce overheads, working to deliver cost savings. It's aiming for cost savings of $120 million on an annualized basis. And also, it's been able to reduce its debt from $322 million at the end of last year to $22 million for the half year, which is pretty bloody good going by any standards. So the company said also its long-term fundamentals remained robust. There was ongoing demand for new housing, and also the existing housing infrastructure. It suffered for years from chronic underinvestment. So it sees great potential going forward from that, and has provided guidance going forward that reflects that. So. I read a note that was put out by the broker Atlantic Capital Markets last week on Travis Perkins, and the company that they basically took the view that the company delivered an impressive recovery since the dip off in the COVID period. Obviously, every stock fell really on or around the 18th of March to the lows, but it recovered really quickly after that, and from a technical level, traded above the key sort of 50-day moving average. So we're now at a point where if the shares hold on to the current level, we're going to see a convergence and also a possible golden cross technical configuration, which if you're into technical analysis, that's a bullish sign, because it means the small 50-day average will cross the 200-day moving average, and that's a very bullish technical signal, and it's one of the key signals that technical analysts look for in a chart if we're going to see a change in the price action. So Travis Perkins is approaching that, and we've got the ongoing COVID crisis, which we've just discussed, and the way it's being dealt with. But regardless, there is a perennial shortage of homes in the UK. New homes will be built, existing homes will be maintained, and we are in a strong and buoyant DIY and construction market even now. And I know this because I've got colleagues who work in the construction industry, and they're literally booked up with work for the next year, 18 months. So certainly it may not be the case all over the country, but here in the southeast of England, that would seem to be the case. And of course, Travis Perkins have a very strong presence down here. So the broker Atlantic Capital Markets said that they're confident that Travis will hold on to this 50-day level and push on, and it expects the stock to recover and hit £14 per share by the end of October and November. And looking at where the stock is today, we're seeing the stock trade at £11.39, and it's The chart so far since the drop off in March looks pretty strong, and if we see this price action maintained, if there is a drop off, then clearly we'd have to reassess that. But on the basis of the price action to date, I think we can expect it to press on and hit that £14 target. So good recovery play. Stock offers a dividend of 1.5% as well. So there's a dividend for your troubles. But also there's a very good chance that if it goes on, hits that £14 level, it could even recover the highs just under £17 a share that it was trading at the start of the year, and that's January and February 2020.
Yeah, I'd argue the 200-day moving average is the bull bear line, the granddaddy of all moving averages. Actually, right now the price is below the price is below the 50-day moving average, so it's just come off a little of late. RSI has gone down. But it could be rolling over. Who knows? I think we could. If we have some more bad news, we could retest these lows. I think in certain stocks, just sentiment-wise, because we've had a decent sort of bounce back. But now, in the American markets, you've seen tech stocks coming off now, and there we are. But it's a stock picker's market, and if you're looking, depends on your horizon, doesn't it? If your investing horizon is 12 months, 2 years, it's fine. If you're a trader, I don't know what you're going to do with it, really. But, I'm investing in stocks now, thinking, okay, in 2 years' time, this won't be here. This is cheap now compared to where it'll be in 2 years' time. But there we are. What's next, Al?
Well, just on that subject, I think the anecdotal evidence in the construction market and industry is very strong, and certainly that you know, I've spoken to a number of people in the building trade. I know people who sort of work.
I agree, and also there's uncertainty around as well. I mean, even the housing market is a bit, apparently on the market. I checked the guys there quite a few times. The CEO. Their traffic, it may be just down to them, but they are gaining traction, and their traffic is an all-time high on the market.com. But when there's uncertainty around, people tend not to make a big purchase and move house, do they? They tend to do their own house up, you know, rather than try and get the maximum value. Yep. And in fact, I'm thinking of doing it now. I've been looking at moving as well, but I'm thinking, should we just get the extension done, you know, because it's a lot less money than actually moving house when you pay all the fees and all that stuff. So get an extension, an extension done, or just move. I don't know. And then I'm thinking of going to the extension. So, I know it is. I suspect it is quite bullish, the doing up market and DIY market. Okay, cool. What's next, Al?
Okay, so moving on, this is a company that we've spoken about on several occasions, and I believe you've had them on the podcast too, Itaconics, ITX. We spoke about them a lot last year, and this company's had an eventful year, to say the least, but it literally came back from the dead because it issued a statement in March this year, and it basically warned that it had enough funds to continue up to the end of May 2020, and of course along with the other stocks and the COVID fall off, it was trading on the bottom. Nonetheless, just to sort of go into what Itaconics is all about, the company produced sustainable bio-based environmentally friendly products and polymers derived from itaconic acid that are used in laundry, water softening, detergents, has applications for agriculture and industry. And throughout the past year, they've been developing commercial relationships with some of the big manufacturers of washing powders and detergents. In February, they announced they developed the BioAsterix additive for biodegradable plastic, and they announced a collaboration in March with a biodegradable packaging company using the BioAsterix application we're moving forward on that. And then, of course, we have the news on the funding and the concerns and the uncertainties going forward. Going back to February, the company also announced that it had received a new order for Itaconics detergent from a second European customer. Obviously, they'd announced the first one a few months earlier, and also they had signed a new supply and license agreement with the washing powder and detergent manufacturer New Wave. Back to May, the company said that it had received a COVID relief package of $10,000, which would take it forward a few months. But it had seen revenues of $600,000, up 42% on last year. And also the initial orders for the joint venture with New Wave to supply New Wave detergents were coming thick and fast and were ahead of plan. On the back of that, the company then raised $1.7 million in a placing at 1.1p, which was oversubscribed. And back in July, there was a trading update. The company reported strong momentum with revenues of $1.1 million for the first 6 months, up 62% on last year. Still had $0.5 million net cash in the bank after the fundraise. And looking forward, the CEO basically said, looking forward, John Shaw said that they were looking and expected to see aggregated revenue potential of some $20 million on the year, which is quite a turnaround.
Yeah, I hate it when people say that about pipelines. It just doesn't mean anything. You can say, it's just a ramp in my mind. And I know John is generally doesn't ramp, but I mean, it's like what's the conversion rate in that? Well, I held Itaconics, and I changed my mind on them. I think maybe they're too small. Maybe they're too small to be listed because their growth, you know, even though it's quite impressive, it's from a very small base. And I thought, will they get traction? And they seem to be getting a bit of traction now, but it's still quite small compared to What are they valued at? Just over 8 million? The revenue is going to be...
Market cap of 7.5 million, and I mean, shares literally fell off the cliff, didn't they?
It was almost like it wasn't a going concern. It was like they were going to delist, and I thought maybe that they should go private. But then they seem to be turning it around. But when people say they've got a pipeline of 20 million, lots of companies say that. It doesn't mean anything, because you know how much of that you're going to convert realistically, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, I think the joint venture with New Wave, I think that's where they're basing their hope, and certainly it's moving forward. But I think to jump from 1 million to 20 million, that's quite a step forward in imagination, really, isn't it? So whether they'll hit that or not, I don't know. But the one thing is, if they are able to build substantially on that 1.1 million revenue figure, then it does make the company very much a going concern and an investable proposition. Currently got a market cap, as I said, for 7.5 million, and shares are trading at 1.75p. So getting back towards that year high again. Maybe now is the time. Maybe Articonics finally has done the hard yards and is in a position to deliver exponential growth. But time will tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, time will tell. I believe that. Time tells everything. Cool. What's next,
Al? It does everything. Yeah, it does. Okay. So I've spoken about this on a few occasions recently, but this is a great company, and we're back to mining and resources, and a small company with a portfolio of assets that I think in the current environment we're in are proving very attractive to investors. This is Power Metal Resources, POW. Prisoner of War is the epic code. POW. Shares have traded as high as 1.48p and as low as 0.18p. So it's had a very eventful year. If you've gone at the low, sort of below, well, which was literally in March, I mean, the shares have just rocketed since then. So it's been a multi-bagger for people holding from that point. Why are the shares attractive? It's got a The company has a range of assets in gold, silver, precious metals, and rare earth metals. And I'll just basically itemize this as we go through and then just give you some updates. The company, of course, is run by CEO Paul Johnson, who's well known throughout the mining community. The chairman is Andrew Bell, who is also chairman, of course, of Red Rock Resources, and Scott Brown is on the board too. So the key project for the company.
Paul's well known, isn't he, through private investors in small cap mining or exploration companies? He's not. I wouldn't say. Is he well known throughout the mining community?
I think he's pretty well known.
Likes of BHP and Rio Tinto. He's well known amongst those.
He's possibly not at that high, but then he's not operating with those companies yet, is he? But I think the fact is that
no, Paul is a very successful investor, and he's very successful at raising awareness for, you know, small exploration stocks. And he's done very well himself. He's a sharp guy, and I've enjoyed him in the podcast. But I don't know if he's well known throughout the entire mining community. I mean, he's not a miner, is he?
No. He's not a miner, but he's an investor. He's an accountant that operates in the sector and is a very canny investor. And I think people follow him because of that. I mean, metaphorically, the mining community. Maybe I'm referring to the community that we're talking to, and the community that follow Vox Markets.
AIM investors and explorers.
AIM investors and explorers, and also TSX and ASX investors too, who follow these companies.
Paul's been instrumental in a lot of microcap companies. I remember when he used to come on the podcast, when it was just you and him, I think. It was about my only guest at the start, and he used to come on once a week, pretty much, talk about Metal Tiger, and I said, you're doing a lot there, and Metal Tiger wasn't moving, and all of a sudden it pretty much five-bagged overnight.
Yes.
I'm glad I was holding, but Paul, fair play. You know, he did a lot for Metal Tiger, and it's a lot more popular now due to him. And in fact, a lot of companies have been involved with him. I know a lot of people have a go at him, saying he's a bit of a ramper and all that stuff sometimes, you know, on Twitter. The thing is, it's funny. People only accuse others of being rampers, you know, if they don't hold the stock that's being ramped. So exactly, if they're in the stock, they don't mind
it. If they're on board and they're making, then they're happy. Ramp away, indeed. Yeah, but that's the thing. I mean, Paul understands how powerful social media is in the sectors in which he operates, and he used it very well. But I mean,
I remember a certain period of time. I'm sure there's an RNS for Metal Tiger once a day. it seemed like every day. I thought, wow. And obviously people share that, and his follower count went up massively. So there we go.
Well, I think he's actually repeated that feat with Power Metal Resources, because the company has this burgeoning portfolio of assets, and it's literally the last few months he's been operating at breakneck speed simply because of the rate of acquisitions and also the developments in the existing assets they own. Of course, there's the joint venture Red Rock Australasia, which is a 49% owned joint venture with Red Rock Resources. And they have somewhere in the region of 18 to 1900 square kilometres in the Ballarat area in Victoria. And of course, this is where ECR Minerals are also operating with the Creswick and Bayliston licences. All the license areas have extensive evidence of gold mineralization in that region. Of course, we have the Fosterville mine, which is produced about 620,000 ounces of gold last year. The Costerfield mine, the Ballarat mine. So this is they are developing and progressing the assets in that area. Even though, of course, they've got the COVID lockdown in Victoria, which is making movement and restricting movement in the area. So. There's been a lot of news out on that recently. I'm going to rattle through these projects because there are so many of them, but that's why we're seeing so many RNSs come out, because the company is moving on at a rate of knots. I spoke about Kavango Resources in another podcast over the weekend, and Kavango Resources have a number of projects in Botswana, and one of the projects they have down there is the Ditau Kemp project, which aside from being a base metals project, has potential for rare earth. That's neodymium and praseodymium. There are magnetites identified in the area, which are thought to be hosting these key rare earth metals. As a result of an investment made into that Power Metal Resources now owns a stake in the Ditau Kemp project with an option to acquire up to 50% depending on the progress at Ditau Kemp. So the company, there's an aeromagnetic survey that's been undertaken that's identified these targets, and we're going to have more news on that, no doubt, in the next little while. Company also has an 18% stake in Kalahari Key Minerals Exploration, which 100% owns the Malopo Farms project complex, and that is a project that's prospective for nickel, copper, and, of course, PGM metals. I'm not going to go into details about the Cameroon projects, but there's a cobalt project in Cameroon, a cobalt copper project in the DRC. Also, the Haneti nickel project, which is run by Katoro Gold. The company has a stake and it's under 25% interest. In fact, it's now under 35% interest, with an additional payment made a few weeks ago to Katoro Gold. So that's in Tanzania, of course. Developments across in the US as well. The Alamo Gold Project, 100% owned by Frisco Gold Corporation. The company has an option to earn in by a series of stage payments where it can earn up to 75%, and some initial scoping work is underway there. And most recently, in Canada, they have acquired a portfolio of claims in the Silver Peak project, which is in British Columbia, part of the old Eureka Victoria silver mine in that region, which is the first Crown-granted mineral property in British Columbia. And again, work has been ongoing there. There was an announcement recently on the progress that had been undertaken in that region. Samples have been taken, and those samples have been sent off for 11 channel samples, in fact, and these samples have been submitted for assay testing to a company in Vancouver. So the background picture is that we have a range of assets and projects primarily based around precious metals. And of course, we all know what's happening with the gold price, with the silver price at present, and the expectations for those metals, the value of those metals going forward, on account of the fact that we have this huge amount of spending taking place by governments around the world using fiscal currency, which of course ultimately will devalue the currency because they're having to print more money to basically purchase assets and keep the markets and keep the world moving forward. Hello?
Yeah, sorry. Oh, you finished, Alan, have you?
Yes.
Do you know what? I didn't know you lost me on pound metals. I know they're invested all over the place, but I don't know what... What's the strategy then? I don't understand. What's this early greenfield and exploration? What have they achieved there?
Well, the rationale to me is pretty obvious. You've got a range of projects here, and also there are some greenfield projects that probably are untouched.
I've got it. I looked at their presentation here. It says they're seeking large-scale mineral deposits. That's it.
Yeah, okay. Large-scale mineral deposits. Simply because I think a number of commentators in the sector and so-called experts in the sector are also saying the same thing. And that is, we are seeing a resurgence in the junior mining sector on account of base metals and huge mineral deposits increasing in value because effectively fiscal currency is being devalued. So these are tangible assets that are increasing in value, of course, particularly with a focus on gold and silver. And the gold and silver price progress over the past 6 months is well documented. But Power Metal have acquired a range of assets and these assets are obviously increasing in value. And if you looked at this company maybe, I don't know, even 6 months ago, a year ago, the value of these metals, the value of gold and silver was much lower then. So it wasn't feasible financially to attack and look at these projects. But with modern survey techniques, with modern desktop technology to examine the potential within these mining projects, all that has changed. So companies like Power Metals can acquire these projects, and indeed there are other companies doing this as well. They're acquiring projects and tracts of land which hitherto would have been regarded as just a bit of land, and of course these are now prospective for these minerals. So it's an exciting time for the industry, and I think certainly Paul and other people have said that the junior mining industry has been ignored for years and years, and maybe now it's on the turn and things are changing.
Mm-hmm. Right, it's been ignored for years and years. Certain companies have done well. Depends how hard they're ramped, you know.
Yeah, well, there is that, but obviously the bigger mining companies have a greater resource and they have different economies of scale, so they can look at a project and say, well, because we're already working here, we'll just divert some resources over there, and in they go and they come up with the stuff. But if you've got that license outright and you're out in the middle of nowhere, it's a little more difficult to do that. But that's the exciting thing. These projects that have been ignored because they're out in the middle of nowhere, difficult access, the cost per ton of the raw material you're trying to get out isn't that high, then there's no point in doing anything. But when that changes, of course, it's got to be looked at again.
Okay. Well, anything else about it? All done?
That's it. All done today, Jess.
Lovely. Speak you next week. Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Ceres Power Holdings, up 7.5% to 5.72. At 4, Power Metals, down 4% to 1.2. At Rock Power Resources, 1.15, non-mover. At 2, New Oil and Gas, non-mover, 0.0275. And at 1, N4 Pharma up 3.2%, 6.45 pence. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, it is Cadence Minerals. Excellent drill results at Yangibana. Yangibana, I think I'm saying that right. Am I saying that right? At four, Dev Clever Holdings partnership announcement. At three, Velocis half year report. At two, Perez Investments, a Vivid Q update. And at one, N4 Pharma interim results. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.